Kidney stones are small, hard mineral deposits that form inside the kidneys. They can be very painful, but don't usually cause long-term damage. However, they do recur. So how does a kidney stone form? What makes it happen? And how can you get rid of them? For the answers to these and other questions, stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Kidney stones are on the increase, and that's likely to be due to a number of reasons, mostly to do with diet and lifestyle. Let's get inside kidney stone disease from Mission Pharmacal.
A kidney stone can be as small as the head of a pin, almost invisible to the naked eye. But as every stone former knows, the pain resulting from this tiny crystal structure can be enormous. Inside kidney stone disease. Kidney stones, or renal calculi, are aggregates of crystals enclosed in a matrix that develop within the kidneys. They're classified according to the specific types of crystals they contain and fall into five major categories: calcium oxalate, calcium phosphate, struvite, uric acid, and cysteine. The most common is calcium oxalate. How is a stone formed? The first step is nucleation. Ions such as calcium and oxalate that have been filtered into the urine by the kidney spontaneously join together to form a solid crystal nidus. This is called nucleation.
Ooh, that looks painful. You can see why passing kidney stones often requires heavy-duty pain relievers. We have two urologists with us today, but first, the news. In the headlines today, kidney stones on the increase, baby's brain builds with mother's fitness, and melamine in soup. The prevalence of kidney stones has increased by 70% over 13 years and has almost tripled since the 1970s. This is the finding of the most recent NHANES survey. The previous survey in 1994 showed 1 in 20 Americans are affected by stones. That number has now risen to 1 in 11. And for minority ethnicities, there's been a tenfold increase. Now, 1 in 5 men over the age of 60 report having had kidney stones. Be aware and minimize your risk by replacing tea, coffee, colas, and chocolate with plenty of good drinking water. Pregnant women who exercise as little as 20 minutes three times a week can advance their newborn's brain activity. Researchers at the University of Montreal studied the brain activity of babies born to two groups of women, those assigned to an exercise program and those who were not. All women wore pedometers and accelerometers and kept an activity log. The babies of the women assigned to the exercise arm of the experiment had brains that were more fully developed. So take a 30-minute walk every day during pregnancy. You'll improve your baby's brain development and improve your own health. Melamine is a common plastic that's previously been linked to kidney stones and renal impairment in children and adults. As a source of nitrogen, it's actually been added to fertilizers, pesticides, and some cattle feeds. So it may be detected in meat, fish, milk, and eggs as it moves up the food chain. In a small study recently, participants ate hot noodle soup from either melamine or ceramic bowls. The melamine group had significantly more melamine in their urine. So avoid melamine tableware, especially when eating hot foods, and never ever put it in the microwave. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Now in the studio is Dr. Myron Murdoch, urologist from Mid-Atlantic Urology Associates. He's the founder of an award-winning medical website, hisandherhealth.com. And joining us out of California from Loma Linda University Urology Medical Group is Dr. Dwayne Baldwin. He's a urologist with expertise in the area of minimally invasive procedures and lithotripsy. I asked him why kidney stones are on the increase.
You know, that's an interesting question, and a lot of the researchers and the epidemiology of stone disease have been wondering that exact same question. One thing we know for sure is we're not doing a very good job in our diets. Probably another factor is that vitamin waters have become very popular. It's pretty rare that someone will be drinking from a water bottle and just have it be regular water. They're often added with things like vitamin C, which is converted to oxalate, which is a risk factor for stones. I think another real problem is the epidemic of obesity, and obesity is a very significant risk factor for stone disease. So I think there are very many reasons, but certainly our bad diet is a major contributor.
So it seems that lifestyle is really contributing to this problem. Now, Dr. Murdoch, are kidney stones a disease in themselves, or are they actually, is there something deeper than that?
In many cases, it's the result of some other problem. So depending on where you live in the United States, there are different problems. For instance, in the south of the United States, or even southwest where it's very warm, it's important to drink lots of fluids. And if you don't drink enough fluids, the urine becomes concentrated. And with concentrated urine, you can have precipitations of crystals that may develop into stones.
So are you saying that there are more kidney stones in the south where it's hotter?
Yeah, in fact, we refer to an area of the south that extends, actually, we're at the tip of it here in Washington, D.C. We call that the Stone Belt. So if you live in North Carolina or South Carolina or Arkansas, those areas of the country tend to have a much higher incidence of stones, not only because it's warm, but possibly because the water that people drink down there may have a much higher than normal mineral content. And that could lead to stones, just like referred before to obesity and food intake. You take in more minerals that are in our water supply, that makes us more prone to stone disease.
Now, Dr. Baldwin, I understand that kidney stones can run in the family. Is that true?
That is definitely true. There are some types of kidney stones which are definitely hereditary. And also the metabolic abnormalities that can occur are also hereditary. So there's certainly cystine stones are definitely hereditary. And, you know, certain metabolic abnormalities that people are predisposed to are also hereditary. So they do tend to run in families.
What sort of metabolic conditions are we thinking of here?
So with cystinuria, it's just a defect in how you break down proteins that results in, excess production of this amino acid cysteine, which can precipitate out and cause kidney stones. Those are some of the worst kidney stone patients that I have. I'll do a major operation and get them cleared out of stone, get them on the ideal diet, and do everything we possibly can, and yet a month later, they'll have filled half their stone with kidney again. It's just such a very aggressive disease.
After the break, we have a professional chef to show us how to make tasty curry. But first, join us outdoors for a couple of minutes.
I love the red candy.
Did you know red dye causes diarrhea, headaches, and even cancer?
What? Well, no more red dye for me. But that's not a problem because I love the blue ones as well.
Well, I hate to tell you, that causes hyperactivity and in children, ADHD.
What are you talking about? So what is there that I can eat that's pleasurable?
There are lots of great tasting foods that are even good for you.
And how do you know the difference?
The closer to nature, the better.
So these candies that are highly refined are probably dubious?
Well, did you ever see candy fall off a tree?
No, I can't say I have.
And likewise, did you ever see anyone dig burger coke and fries out of the garden?
No, you certainly don't.
Well, you remember the saying, if God made it,
eat it.
If man made it,
read it.
And if you can't read it, don't eat it. So if it's food as grown, then it's good for you.
So all the binding, grinding, and refining and adding all those chemical colorings and additives are not very good for you?
Terrible chemistry. Instead, have red strawberries, red raspberries, red plums, and red apples. Doctor's orders.
When I lived in Japan, I had a friend who was an artist. She painted beautiful, intricate designs on silk fabric that were used to make kimonos. She invited me to her studio, and when I walked in, I saw this long table in the middle of this room. And on this table was about 10 to 12 yards of silk fabric. The work that she would do was so detailed, so intricate, but yet so amazingly beautiful. She would take her time, and sometimes it would take her 6 months to finish a 10-yard panel. I visited her one day, but she was doing something very interesting. With a magnifying glass in hand, she was going over every single inch of that fabric, checking her work to make sure that everything was good. It took her a long time because she did it slowly and carefully. And then she put down the magnifying glass, and with a smile of satisfaction on her face, she said, "It is good." The Bible tells us that God created this world and all living things in 6 days, and he rested after he was finished because all was good.
Welcome to Go Healthy's Kitchen, and today we have a special guest, a chef, professional chef in the kitchen with us, and it's Jeremy Dixon, all the way from New Zealand, and he's the chef and owner of Revive Cafe. Jeremy, what are you going to cook for us today?
Well, today this is the most popular recipe in my cafes, and we change our menu every day, and when this one is on, it just sells out no matter how much we make.
Fantastic. So you need a bottomless pan for this.
You definitely do. Make triple, quadruple recipes because it's going to go fast.
Okay. What is it called?
It's a spinach, ginger, pumpkin and tofu curry.
That's quite a mouthful, but it sounds like a very tasty mouthful.
It is. It is delicious.
So tell us, what are the ingredients for this recipe?
Sure. Well, the first ingredient is one medium chopped onion, 1.5 tablespoons of ginger puree, 1 clove of garlic chopped or crushed, 1 tablespoon of oil, 1 rounded teaspoon of powdered cumin, turmeric and coriander, 1 rounded teaspoon of honey or date butter, 1/2 cup of water, 14-ounce can of chopped tomatoes, 1/2 cup of coconut cream, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 cup of pumpkin, roast and diced, and 1 cup of frozen spinach, and 10 ounce of firm tofu cut into cubes.
Wow, that sounds like an amazing combination. So what do we do to start?
Well, the first thing to do is to put a little bit of oil in the pan, and every curry is normally starts off with some onions and garlic and ginger.
You're absolutely right. Every curry would not be a curry without those important things. Now, that ginger does not look like ginger that we normally would think of as ginger in the store.
That's right. Well, it kind of is, but it's much easier if you buy it all pre-prepared. And it's actually a beautiful product. They actually pre-puree it up for you.
Really? So this is it?
It is, yep. And it's a great ingredient to have in your fridge if you want to add a bit of spice or flavour to any meal. It's a great thing to have in the kitchen.
Really? How long will it keep for?
You'll probably use it up before it goes off, probably
really?
At least a couple of months.
Wow.
Just has a lot of spice, a lot of curries and a lot of dishes, and we use it a lot at my cafes.
Wonderful. For people who don't have access to it, can they make their own?
Yep, you can just put some in a blender with a little bit of oil and blend it up and make your own puree. And it's just easier to do that rather than having to get out the ginger, skin it and chop it up. You're not going to use ginger if you have to do that every time you use it, so it just makes it easier to add an instant flavour hit.
Whoa, nice. So does that mean we can do that to garlic as well?
No, garlic must be used fresh. It's a food crime to use pre-prepared garlic.
Is that right?
So if you use it, I'm going to have to make a citizen's arrest.
Oh dear, I'm in trouble.
Exactly.
So how is this going here?
Well, it's just going a little bit slow to start with, but these onions will start to cook very shortly.
All right.
So what we're doing is a really nice base of flavour, and if you start your curry with this kind of base of onions and ginger and garlic, it lays a great foundation to add in the rest of the flavours, so it's often a good way to start.
Now, do you want me to start chopping the
tofu?
You can.
We can chop that, so cube it into little cubes.
Okay.
And we'll put that in shortly.
tofu's just going to take on the flavour of whatever you put it with.
Exactly. So. Tofu gets a bad reputation for being a very bland, boring product.
Mm.
But it's great because it soaks up the lovely flavours in this dish.
So you want a good sauce with tofu that will just give it that punch.
That's right.
So,
really
chunky?
A little bit thinner.
Smaller?
Doesn't really matter. Smaller, you can do it however you like.
All right.
And the key with this recipe is to use firm tofu. If you use your softer tofus, they'll generally break up into little pieces. So you want to try firm where you can.
So that's okay, like that?
That's right.
Okay.
It's starting to smell nicely.
It is. It's smelling great.
Now, there's three spices we're going to use today.
Mm.
And these are my three favourite spices. And they just go together amazingly. And that's turmeric, coriander and cumin.
All right, so they're all powdered.
That's
dried,
right.
Powdered. They are my three favourites as well.
They're wonderful. So always have them in your pantry.
Are.
They're a great spice to have.
And they're not stomach irritants like some spices are. They're not nerve irritants.
Exactly.
A number of spices, they don't let you sleep so well at night. But these ones don't seem to interfere with you.
They're great.
Yeah, so that's great.
And also they're not hot. They've just got a flavour. They're not a hot spice. So if you don't like hot food, they're great spices to use.
Right. Because some people, you know, if you're cooking for a bunch of people, you don't want to use a hot spice and find that two or three people don't like the hot spice.
Exactly.
So at what point do you know when to add them to the saucepan?
Well, generally you want your onions becoming clear. We may have to take a little bit of a shortcut today for time. But when your onions become clear, you want to throw them in here and give them a bit of a stir around. They just need a little bit of a heat just to kind of just cook them a little bit.
Mm.
But once you throw your spices in, it starts to dry up. So you need to be ready for the next step.
And what's the next step?
Next step is canned tomatoes, another great ingredient to have in your kitchen.
And they're going, when you put them in, I guess you finish off the cooking of those onions too.
That's right. So you want your onions to be kind of cooked before you put the tomatoes in,
mm-hmm.
or else your dish can taste of raw onion.
Right.
So we throw that in. And the next ingredient is put some honey in.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ever use tomatoes, you generally need, tomatoes are quite acidic, so you generally need a bit of sweetness, so we'll add some
honey. So that's going to cut the acid for you.
Exactly, and just kind of balance off those flavours.
Nice. Now, if someone has diabetes, they might not want to use the honey. So I see you've added some date butter there, which...
That's right. In my cafes, we don't use sugar. We use date butter or date puree, which is just blended dates and water for all of our sweetening. It's a nice, healthy sweetener.
So you mix equal quantities of dates and water, and then blend it up, and you just keep that in the fridge then?
That's right. And use that instead of sugar or honey or any other sweetener. So it's a great natural way of sweetening foods.
Now, I bet there's not many cafes around that do that.
Exactly, I don't
Most
think so.
Most would take the shortcut and just go and
just
get the sugar.
Just putting that white sugar,
yeah,
exactly.
That's right. But that way you, and the reason I mentioned that about with diabetes is you've got the added fibre and therefore you're not going to get such a spike in
temperature and
sugar. All right.
So we can put the tofu in now. So once, you generally let that cook for probably about 5 or 10 minutes until it's nice and cooked through. And then you want to add all these other ingredients right at the end. They don't need to be cooked, just warmed through into the dish.
Okay, so tofu is the first of these ingredients.
And we've got some pumpkin. Pumpkin's a beautiful vegetable to add to this one. Also, butternut squash will do the same job as well. So there's many different kind of pumpkin-y butternut squash things around.
Right.
And we have some frozen spinach.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you want to add this right at the end because it'll go brown if you add it too early.
So the colour will sort of dye the tofu and the pumpkin. And
again, a great ingredient to have in your freezer all the time.
Well, I love the beta carotenes here, the dark green leafy and the bright orange pumpkin. That is going to be loaded with fine chemicals.
Exactly.
A wonderful, wonderful, tasty and nutritious curry there. Thank you so much.
Oh, one more ingredient, coconut cream.
Oh, coconut cream.
Just a bit of coconut cream to finish it off.
This is going to be so rich and creamy.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
This is a beautiful curry to serve on. You can either serve it on rice or quinoa or any kind of whole grain.
Mmm, fabulous. Thank you for that lovely recipe. Let's try it. I'm dying to try this.
Great.
There you go, you're armed now.
A little bit of cilantro on top gives a nice bit of decoration as well.
Yeah. For people who like cilantro.
Mm-hmm, exactly. They can use parsley rather.
Mmm,
that's great.
That's really good. I love that ginger flavour coming through.
Cool.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks, Nira, no worries.
And now part two of the video from Mission Pharmacal. Let's find out how many people are affected and what exactly causes their kidney stones.
In the U.S., it is estimated that 13% of men and 7% of women will develop a kidney stone during their lifetime. Fortunately, in about 78% of these patients, stones will be expelled spontaneously. But stones that become lodged in the ureter may require lithotripsy or percutaneous or endoscopic removal. It's important to note that nearly half of all first-time stone formers will have another stone episode within the next 4 years. Recurrent stone formers are at even greater risk and may form a new stone every 2 or 3 years. But what actually causes crystals to form? Why do some crystals develop into kidney stones and others do not? One critical factor is supersaturation of the urine with stone-forming salts. Supersaturation is the driving force for crystallization. In undersaturated urine, crystals cannot form. The other important factor is a deficiency in substances called inhibitors. Inhibitors retard the nucleation, growth, and aggregation process by binding ions needed for crystal formation and growth. One of the most important inhibitors is citrate. The economic burden of kidney stones is significant, with medical costs reaching billions of dollars annually.
And those costs are spiraling as rates rise. Now, back to our expert urologists. We've heard about the increased risk from dietary choices, obesity, and family history. I asked Dr. Baldwin if there were other risk factors for kidney stones.
One factor is your job. And there was a study that I just heard about, which was very interesting. They looked at Marines who were out in the desert of Southern California. And just by the nature of their work, being out in the desert, they were drinking an average of 19 liters of fluid a day, and yet they were dehydrated with extremely high stone risk for stone formation. So certain careers place you by their nature, construction workers, people who are outside doing manual labor, sweating a lot, are at very high risk just from the basis of their job that they have.
My, that's phenomenal, 19 liters a day.
I'm not sure I could consume 19 liters.
No, I think I'd be hard-pushed to get that through. So tell us, how do people find out that they have stones, Dr. Murdoch? Is there a... do they always have symptoms, or can they be silent, or do you find them some other way?
Well, what we classically think of patients who have stones is they come in with what we call renal colic. High back pain, what we refer to as flank pain, frequently radiating to the upper abdomen, then down towards the lower abdomen and down to the groin area. And sometimes when the stones really get low down, they may be associated with urinary symptoms like urge and frequency, burning on urination. Many times blood is associated with it. We frequently see that when we look in the microscope. We refer to this as microscopic hematuria. But some patients actually can see the blood in the urine, so they'll have pain, urgency, frequency, blood in the urine, and frequently associated with it is nausea and vomiting. So this is the typical renal colic pain. On the other hand, the more dangerous type is the type where there are no symptoms. And patients can have very large stones, obstructing stones, that cause no symptoms, and they just continue on causing damage to their kidneys. And that's the whole idea. If you don't find somebody, obviously if somebody has symptoms, you have to relieve the symptoms. But if people have no symptoms and they don't know they have a problem, then silent damage can occur.
And what does the damage come from? Why are they dangerous, those stones?
Well, two things. One is infection. Many of these stones that are silent are what we refer to as infection stones or triple phosphate stones. Magnesium ammonium phosphate is what they're made of. And the basis for these stones is bacteria. And the bacteria break down ammonia and urea, and that causes stone formation. And these stones can get quite large, and over time, the bacteria can destroy the kidneys, and the stone itself can obstruct the kidneys. And an obstruction with infection is actually much more serious than no obstruction at all. Mm. And so, just about every week, I see a new patient coming in with what we call a staghorn calculus, a stone that actually fills the entire kidney like a stag's horn, and they have literally no symptoms. They'll come in because their doctor finds they have renal insufficiency, their kidneys aren't working well, and associated with this may be anemia, on doing a routine urinalysis, the primary care doctor finds that there's pus or blood in the urine, and when x-rays are performed, they find that there's this huge stone that has basically been symptom-free over many years.
Dr. Baldwin, we just mentioned an x-ray, but what other imaging techniques are useful for stones, and what's the best one?
The three mainstays for detecting imaging tests for detecting stones is renal ultrasound, which is usually the first imaging modality that we get. And the beauty of getting a kidney ultrasound is that it has no radiation exposure with it. It provides pretty good sensitivity and specificity for large renal stones, although it's not very good for ureteral stones. And then a plain x-ray is often one of the first studies that we do, which will show 85% of kidney stones that have calcium in them. They'll be seen on a plain x-ray. More and more nowadays, though, we've moved to getting CT scans, and we'll get a non-contrast CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. It's a very remarkable technology. They can do the whole CT scan in about 4 seconds. They get very good quality images. And, it's very sensitive, 98% plus sensitivity and specificity. But the only problem that's probably a good thing to know about is that they are associated with very high radiation exposure. And a lot of people don't realize it, but just getting one single CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis will result, if 1,000 people get that CT scan, one of those patients will end up dying of a cancer because of that radiation exposure. And here at Loma Linda, we've been doing a lot of research in trying to reduce the radiation exposure that kidney stone patients get. You know, as we talked about, stones tend to recur, and about 50% of patients who get a kidney stone, the stones will come back. And if they come back and they get repeat CT scans, that amount of radiation can add up. And three of those CT scans would be the same as one of the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki who are standing about 3 kilometers away from where the nuclear blast went off. So it's a tremendous amount of radiation, but working with our radiology colleagues, we've found a way to cut that radiation down so that we can give about 5% of the radiation dose. And because kidney stones are dense, we can still detect the stones. And so basically that's a very low dose CT scan. And that's our standard protocol that we use in patients nowadays when they come in the ER, because it's very fast, has less radiation than even a plain x-ray, and is very sensitive and very specific.
Well done. That sounds great. Now, what percentage of kidney stones are going to be passed spontaneously, Dr. Murdoch, without any help from anyone else?
Probably most.
Really?
Most kidney stones are passed spontaneously. I mean, there are a lot of kidney stones that people have, they don't even know they have them. And so you never know if they pass them. But I think, most stones, particularly stones that are under 5 millimeters in diameter, if they're relatively smooth, they will pass spontaneously on their own. So, when one has a stone, there's an art to taking care of patients with kidney stones. And you have to look at the patient, you have to look at what equipment you have, your techniques as a surgeon and a urologist, this particular situation with the patient, maybe he has work situations or travel situations, the size of the stone, the shape of the stone, all determines how you go about taking care of the patient, whether you're going to intervene earlier or whether you're going to give the patient a chance to pass the stone spontaneously.
And are there medications that can help the patient pass them?
Yeah, particularly if the stone reaches the mid or lower third ureter. That's the urine tube that goes from the kidneys to the bladder. We're using drugs that are called alpha blockers. They're frequently used in patients who have prostate enlargement with obstruction. They tend to relax the muscles that innervate the lower ureter and the sort of the neck of the bladder. And when the stone reaches that area, if you use these drugs, the relaxing effect tends to help the stones pass more easily, and there's a greater chance of passing the stone spontaneously without having to intervene. But we're assuming that the stone is, less than 5 millimeters in general.
Our experts have more to share right after the break. Irritations in life are like crystals in the kidney. We can dwell on the annoyance until it crystallizes into a major obstacle to our happiness. Or we can turn our focus away to more pleasant things. And like an inhibitor in the kidney, the annoyance will remain comparatively minor and in time just disappear. In Philippians 2, God promises to make us willing and able to do everything without grumbling or arguing. That seems impossible, doesn't it? We live in a world where grumbling and arguing, fighting for our rights and going to war are just the norm. Imagine, the contrast could be so striking. But how? Well, the key is given in Philippians 4. It says, in every situation, pray with thanksgiving, presenting your requests to God. And His peace, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. And then we're told to think on those things that are true and noble, right and pure, lovely and admirable. Are you longing for that peace that passes understanding? Then try this today. You'll avoid the pain and complications that challenges typically bring. Instead, you'll rise above them.
All day long, I solve problems. It's nuts and bolts and grease. And I love it. But at the end of the day, I think about the world's problems. I wonder why we're all here and how it will end. And I found something that makes sense of it all. Takes the nuts and bolts of history and paints a bigger picture. Now, I have hope.
I hope you've got your phone book because Sean has his toys out and we're about to work out together.
There you go. So what we're going to do today, we're going to use a step up, which is kind of cool. You could use a regular stairs, anything you can find, a curb, which is really cool. Let's start with some jumping jacks, but this time we're going to do some low jacks, all right?
All right.
Working those quads, all right? Hands here, and we're just going to come very low, okay? Not high like normal, right? In three, we're going to do five of them. Three, two, and one. Go. One, two, three, four, and five, okay? Again, just a relaxed exercise, brings the heart rate up a little bit, prepares the body for exercise. All right, so you got your curb, you got your step, you got your box, whatever you want to use.
All right.
And what we're going to do is an alternating toe tap, okay? And this is a fun exercise because it just tests your agility a little bit, all right? Mm. And you can set a timer for about 30 seconds. We're going to test you for 10 seconds, all right? All I want you to do is tap. There you go, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, there you go, 5. 4, 3, 2, and 1. This is a great exercise you can add in the gym if you're doing anything that's very low, stationary, and kind of relaxed exercise.
Right.
You can throw this in just to kind of bring up your heart rate a little bit.
And it just,
there you go.
Perks you right up.
There
good,
you go.
Good intermittent training there.
We're going to take, you hold on to one. What
All
we're
right.
going to do is called a wood chop, okay? The weight is going to be here, and we're just going to put this weight on the shelf, okay?
All
very
right.
functional exercise. Pivot here. Boom. Back here, squat down a little bit, and I want you to intentionally pivot that left foot. All right? You take your time. You can use a medicine ball. You can use a kettlebell that we've used before in other episodes.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You can use anything or any weight. All right? Let's do the opposite side in 3, 2, and 1. All the way to the side.
So this is giving us good, you know, when people are not really stretching,
that's right.
They just sit at the desk all day.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to really bring a good stretch in.
Absolutely.
Gets the joints moving.
One more.
The back twisting.
And perfect.
And right. works a bit of muscle while we're at it.
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of core, a lot of the abdominal area, still also kind of engaging muscles that are kind of dormant throughout the day.
Yeah.
All right.
We're going to grab both. And they're not used to working on those.
Actually, keep both of those.
Okay.
We're talking about stretching. And that's the exact next exercise. It's called
a
deadlift. So the weight is going to be here, chest up, take a nice deep breath, okay? And we're gonna keep your legs straight and you're gonna go all the way down, stretching out your hamstring. Now you sit all day, if depending on what you do, mm-hmm. you sit all day, and sometimes it's just good just to get a nice stretch of these hamstrings and then come up. There you go. Perfect, give me one more. All the way down, stretch those hamstrings, stretch out the hamstring, and then come up nice and slow.
And just it's interesting to see how much further you go each
yep.
time.
Yep.
You know, I'm almost on the floor there now.
That's right.
Yeah.
The more relaxed you get. Now, what we can do just to make that just a little more interesting is you can throw in that bicep curl, all right, here,
mm-hmm.
and do a full rotation of your wrist and come all the way up. There you go. Now, just your simple exercise, you can take it up a notch. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And back up.
So you maximize coming up.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you're all done. So you got three exercises, you got a timer, and you can get a nice little workout in. All right?
Excellent.
There you go. So just let's cool it down a little bit.
Okay.
Take a nice deep breath. We're going to bring our chest to our knee. All right? We're going to go to the right knee. Take a nice deep breath.
All right.
And come down. You're reaching for your sneaker, bringing your chest to your knee, and stretching out that same hamstring that we just engaged for the deadlift. All right? Come up nice and slow.
And we can bend that knee.
You can bend a little bit, depending on your flexibility. And all the way back down again. In 3, 2, and 1. Good job.
Excellent. Thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
Gallstone disease is painful and often requires the surgical removal of the gallbladder. Is there a way to avoid developing the disease in the first place? Men who ate nuts at least 5 times a week were found to be 30% less likely to develop gallstones. According to the Health Professional Study published in 2004, the men enjoyed hazelnuts, peanuts, and cashews and avoided the pain of gallstones. Enjoying nuts most days of the week is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time to answer the questions that you've sent me by Facebook, phone, or text. On Facebook, Yula Miller writes, my dad often gets stomachache that's followed by spitting blood. What sickness is this and how can it be cured? Well, Yula Miller, it may be a stomach ulcer or it may be something even more serious. I think your dad needs to see a doctor because bleeding is a serious condition. Sometimes it can get worse suddenly, and if it's a little bit, a lot, then he's going to get anemic as well. So he definitely needs to see a doctor. Gertrude wrote and said, I've had a slight stroke. 2 fingers are good, but my arm and 3 fingers are weak. What exercises are going to help to strengthen it? Well, Gertrude, it's important to try and involve your weak arm. It's easier just to leave it out of the activities, but it's important to involve it in everything that you do. So if you're doing something that normally would use 2 hands, you need to bring your weak arm in and your hand, just like you saw us demonstrate on the show about strokes. You might even want to get a squeeze ball and be working that hand and arm when you're sitting down so that it's always active and involved. That way your brain can rewire to that area. Also, be sure to straighten all those joints several times a day so that those muscles and those tendons get lengthened regularly. Otherwise, they'll shorten up permanently. Flora called and said, when I fast, I get shaky. So are there foods that I can eat during a fast? Well, instead of a total fast, you might want to try a fruit fast where you have 2 or 3 pieces of fruit instead of a meal. Or you could have a fast with freshly made juice, like carrot juice as a base, and then lots of greens, cucumber, and perhaps a little beetroot. Don't do more than 1/4 of a beetroot at a time. And you could make up, say, 2 quarts of that, keep it in the fridge, and then have 2 glasses each time you would normally have a meal, so 3 meals a day. Thanks for those questions. Remember to call us and leave your health question for me to answer here on the show. That number is 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. To text or call from overseas, it's 301-960-5144. Or you can leave your health question on our Go Healthy for Good Facebook page. Now, speaking of juicing, let's see what's at the grocer's today. Fennel is a vegetable that grows as a weed in many areas. Every part of the plant is edible. The flowers are the most potent. Seeds are best used fresh and are an essential ingredient in spice mixtures in the East. It's been reported to help colic in babies digestion in adults, menstrual pain in women, coughs, and if the seeds are powdered and left in kennels and stables, it drives the fleas away. The leaves are delicately flavored and can be used in soups or added to salads. The bulb is a crisp vegetable that can be sauteed, stewed, braised, grilled, or eaten raw. Its Italian name is Pinocchio, rhymes with Pinocchio. Bon appetit. Stones under 5 millimeters or 1/6 of an inch are likely to get stuck in the kidney or in the ureter. In years past, for larger stones, an incision would be made over the kidney and the stones would be removed surgically. With his expertise in minimal access techniques, I asked Dr. Baldwin about how he manages these larger stones with lithotripsy.
So lithotripsy is sort of a broad term, and litho means stone and tripsy means the breaking of stones. So, you know, that's sort of a broad term which encompasses several different technologies. When many people talk about lithotripsy, they're talking about shockwave lithotripsy, which is a technique where a totally non-invasive manner, the patient just lies on a table, and a shockwave, which is similar to a baby earthquake, is generated. And it passes up through a column of water. Back in the early days, in the very first machines, and I remember using one of these one time, we had to strap the patient into this special chair, and then we had a robotic arm that would drop them into a little baby swimming pool, and then the shockwave would be transmitted through the swimming pool to the patient. But nowadays we're a little more sophisticated, and the patient just lies on our table, and the column of water is brought to them, and this little baby earthquake goes transmitted through the water very smoothly. It meets the tissues of the patient, and because the tissues of the patient have living tissue, they move with the earthquake and no damage happens to them or very little. But then when the earthquake gets to the stone is brittle and it breaks up because it can't expand and contract and move with this moving shockwave as it passes through the patient. So that's the simplest, perhaps, and the easiest way of breaking up kidney stones.
How long does that take?
Well, it depends on several different parameters. A standard treatment cycle with many types of machines, it's about an hour. Recently, we've done some research and we've realized we used to do it. If you'd asked me 4 years ago, I would have said it takes 30 minutes, or actually 24 minutes. But we've realized that when we slow down the treatment shocks, and we now treat at a very slow rate of one per second, basically, and there's less damage to the patient and more effective fragmentation. So it's about an hour for that procedure.
And do they require anesthetic?
It can be done with sedation, what's called sedation medicine, to kind of help you just relax, and some pain medicine. But the studies have shown that when the patients are awake, they tend to move a little bit. And if they're moving a little bit, then the stone isn't centered. You know, the baby earthquake that passes through the patient is very small. And that's the beauty of it, is it doesn't have much collateral damage. It's very focused. And so if the patient were to move and the stone would move with the patient, then it's no longer in the path of the shockwave. So they've done studies, and they've shown that if you're asleep under what's called a general anesthetic, then the success rate is higher. So most of the time it's done under a general anesthetic nowadays.
Thank you. And what about surgical options, Dr. Murdoch? If lithotripsy is not appropriate, when would we use surgery?
Well, when I was a resident, we always used surgery. We're tending more towards minimally invasive procedures. Shockwave lithotripsy is one of these minimally invasive procedures, and it is surgery because it requires anesthetic. But there are other ways to approach the stones. For instance, there are situations in which we can put a special scope, into the bladder and up the urine openings that go up into the kidney. We call this a ureteroscopy, using a scope that's called a ureteroscope. And so we can actually go up, visualize the stones either in the urine tubes, the ureter, or actually in the kidney itself, in the renal pelvis, and the little branches of the renal pelvis. And we can either grab the stone if it's small enough, or we can use some form of lithotripsy, frequently laser lithotripsy, to break the stone up into multiple small pieces and then grab the pieces and remove them directly from the ureter or from the kidney. In other situations where the stones are much larger, you may have to actually enter the kidney through the back, and we call this percutaneous approach, and you enter the kidney by basically putting a needle into the kidney, and then you have a tract that you dilate bigger and bigger. You put certain kinds of scopes in there, we call it nephroscopes, and then through those scopes we can also destroy the stones, usually with laser, some on rare occasions electrohydraulic type lithotripsy. But we can get into the kidney and the urethra either up through the bladder or through the back, and either grab the stones or destroy the stones. Of course, this is the ideal. There are rare circumstances where you have to actually make an incision and approach the kidney, but that's extremely rare in these days, but was very, very common like 35 or 40 years ago or more.
Now, how do you decide whether to do shockwave lithotripsy or do a surgical or a more invasive
right.
procedure?
Well, it depends on the availability of equipment, the surgeon's technical expertise, and how frequently what's happening to the patient. Does the patient have to travel and has to be absolutely sure that all the fragments are going to be removed? Because if you do, let's say, extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy, you may have a stone that has multiple fragments and the patient has to pass those fragments, and that can cause difficulties at times. One of the problems with shockwave lithotripsy is that if the stone is too big, then you're left with a tremendous load of debris, basically, that has to pass. And so that limits how much of the stone you can destroy by shockwave lithotripsy. So if it gets too big, you may need multiple procedures. And if a patient needs to have it taken care of and be sure that it's taken care of, one may consider ureteroscopic approach and grabbing all the stones under direct vision and not worrying about passage of debris.
After the break, we'll be talking about diet and lifestyle. Stand by.
Death is the only inescapable, unavoidable, sure thing. We are sentenced to die the day we're born.
Death is a debt we all must pay.
Some people are so afraid to die that they never begin to live.
Every man must do two things alone. He must do his own believing and his own dying.
Death is not a period, but a comma in the story of life.
He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.
If you've ever had a stone, then buckle up and see how to prevent going through that ordeal again. Here's the final part of today's video, Inside Kidney Stones.
Dehydration is a major cause of kidney stones, which is why people living in areas with high temperatures and humidity have a higher incidence of stone formation. A diet high in sodium is a double risk, because it increases calcium excretion and reduces urinary levels of stone-inhibiting citrate. Too much animal protein creates similar problems, encouraging stone growth by increasing urinary uric acid and reducing urinary citrate. Certain medications are also known to encourage stone formation or growth in susceptible patients, including common supplements such as vitamin C. There is no cure for kidney stones, But once an acute episode has been resolved, the key to therapy is simple: preventing recurrence. And fortunately, the most common stones, calcium oxalate and calcium phosphate, can be effectively managed with a combination of diet and lifestyle changes and medication. Compliance with proven management guidelines, such as increasing fluid intake and avoiding stone-promoting foods, can significantly reduce stone recurrence. Medical therapies, such as thiazide diuretics and potassium citrate, are also highly effective in appropriate patients and can reduce the need for expensive assisted stone removal procedures, such as shockwave lithotripsy, SWL.
Diet, lifestyle, and medications. It sounds so simple, but it's very effective. Let's get back to our guest experts. I asked Dr. Baldwin if it's important to find out what kind of stones his patients have.
Every patient who comes in to see us, we give them a little strainer and tell them that every time they get up to use the restroom that they must urinate through this little strainer so that we can catch the stone, because if you can catch the stone, you can send it and do a chemical analysis on it and know what type of stone it is. And then combining the information of knowing what type it is, plus looking at their 24-hour urine collections, which is a metabolic study that lets you know all the different components that are in the urine, with those two bits of information, you can really help them strategize on what methods to prevent from forming stones in the future. It sounds like it would be pretty easy to just use that little strainer, but sometimes a stone will take a couple weeks to pass, and patients are not very happy about carrying around this little urine strainer with them when they're going out to dinner and going to church and various other places. So it ends up many times we don't get the stone, and it's a vital part of information that it really is helpful if we can get it.
So our message to our viewers is to be persistent if you have stones and really try and focus on finding out what's in your stones.
Definitely.
Now, Dr. Murdoch, calcium seems to feature quite a bit. What's the message for dietary intake of calcium if there's so much calcium in these stones?
Well, obviously, if you have a calcium stone, which is about 85% of all stones, you would think that it's best to limit your calcium and limit your oxalate, because many stones are also composed of calcium oxalate. You know, there's a lot of things that we eat that have, you know, calcium and oxalate in it. One of the problems we have today is everybody's making a diagnosis of vitamin D deficiency, which, of course, increases calcium absorption. So everybody's getting extra vitamin D now, which is going to make for increased absorption of vitamin D. And I am sure we're going to see more calcium stones as times go on because of this popular therapy. But yes, you're right. A calcium stone, you should limit in most cases your calcium intake, and probably also limit the foods that contain oxalate.
So what contains oxalate?
There's lots of things that contain oxalate. Well, first of all, you know, vitamin C can be metabolized to oxalate.
So supplementing with vitamin C needs to be done cautiously?
Yeah, that's correct. Should be done cautiously.
Dr. Baldwin, give us your top two lifestyle changes that you recommend for someone who's formed stones before.
Probably number one would be drinking more water. In general, when you pass your first stone, we don't do a really complicated evaluation. We know that stones are very common. And the first thing we tell patients is to drink a lot of water. And when we say a lot of water, that means different things to different people. And for some people, drinking 2 cups of water a day seems like a lot of water. They just don't like water. But when I say drink a lot of water, I mean drink a lot of water, like 2 gallons is a target for a recurrent stone former. You know, for someone who's just occasionally forms a stone, you know, probably a gallon would be adequate. But a lot of water is probably the number one simplest thing. And then probably the second point would be don't take vitamin C and D. You know, a lot of people in California, at least the region where I am, we get a lot of sunshine and we probably get plenty of vitamin D. And as Dr. Murdoch pointed out, taking excessive vitamin D may just increase your absorption of calcium. So, you know, I think vitamin C is converted right into oxalate, which is the most important part of that reaction where calcium oxalate come together to precipitate to form a stone in the kidney. And so if we can limit the oxalate, and then the really bad foods that have oxalate are tea and coffee and cola sodas and chocolate and some healthy foods too. Actually, vegetarians, it's kind of bad because some of the healthiest vegetarians who eat very healthfully are, you know, they get a lot of green leafy vegetables and strawberries and lots of beans and things have oxalate also. So probably number one is water, drink a lot of water. Number two is avoid those bad foods and don't take excess vitamin C.
And Dr. Murdoch, very quickly, what would be a couple of other things that people can do?
In the Northeast, stop drinking cranberry juice. And I think keeping your weight down, dietary control, and drinking lots of water and staying away from colas, lots of iced tea and cranberry juice would be very helpful, I think, in reducing, your chance for getting future stones.
And then exercise is important, isn't it? Because I understand that encourages calcium to move to the bones rather than it going to the urine. And that will also help to reduce weight.
Basically, everything that helps cardiac function reduces the incidence of stone disease.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. And thank you, Dr. Baldwin. It's been great having you both. If you want to avoid kidney stones, our experts have repeatedly advised drink copious amounts of water. And that's not mineral or spring water. And limit salt to less than a teaspoon a day. If you need to avoid oxalates, then avoid tea, coffee, cola, and chocolate. And remember that vitamin C is also converted into oxalates, so avoid more than 3,000 milligrams in a day. A diet high in fiber reduces calcium and oxalate absorption. You might also limit your intake of sweet potatoes, peanuts, almonds, spinach, beet greens, wheat bran, and other high oxalate foods. An exception is soy, because while soy contains oxalates, it's also high in phytate, and phytate counteracts the oxalates and may actually protect against kidney stones. Exercise is important for a couple of reasons. For one, it drives calcium into the bones and therefore out of the circulation. And it also helps to maintain a healthy weight. And we know that the risk of stones rises with overweight and obesity. Finally, for uric acid problems, limit your animal protein. And that includes meat, dairy, eggs, and especially fish and shellfish. Beer and wine are also important culprits now. Well, that's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Health for Good. I'll see you next time.